I'd like to call this January 8th, 2020 meeting of the Historic Preservation Commission meeting to order. And we will start with roll call and introductions. And I would like to just make a request that as we go around the room and we say our names, we say them slowly. And, you know, we usually kind of rapid fire around the room, but we have a sign language interpreter and she's got to spell out our names. So let's start with Don on my right, and we'll go around to the left.
My name's Don Trost, and I'm a commission member.
I'm Julie Bond, and I'm a commission member.
Alex Gall, chair.
Michelle Kapitanovich, commission member.
Sean Denniston, vice chair.
Rock Van Lee, commissioner.
Sharon Lumban-Toby, Clark County staff.
Jan Bader, City of Vancouver staff.
Mark Person, City of Vancouver staff.
Thank you. I'd like to start the meeting with a review of last month's meeting's minutes, and I'll give the commissioners a few minutes to review those, and then we'll entertain a motion to approve them when we're ready. Everybody had enough time to review them. Any comments? Any revisions?
Move approval of the minutes as submitted.
I'll second.
All in favor?
Aye.
Aye. So moved. And we can move on. We have with us this evening folks from the Washington School for the Deaf to present I guess, to make a presentation regarding the revitalization project. So I'd like to call forward, and please turn on your microphones and introduce yourselves. And
good evening. Can you hear me? My name is Sean Ballou, and I am the superintendent at Washington School for the Deaf. I am hard of hearing, so I will speak for myself, but sometimes I miss things, and so I will use the ASL interpreter as needed. I am thrilled to be here tonight. I have with me Keith Schreiber. He is an architect that we have been working with for the last 2 years, and he and I will kind of walk you through some of the things that we are thinking about as we move on. First of all, I want to say thank you for giving me this opportunity to speak tonight. WSD is my passion. I am very proud to be a part of the school. WSD is, there we go.
Thank you.
There we go. That is a picture of WSD, Washington School for the Deaf. WSD is part of a larger statewide agency, CDHY. You see that there on the bottom. And that is Center for Deaf and Hard of Hearing Youth. It is responsible for running the School for the Deaf, as well as providing statewide services across the state and providing infrastructure to deaf education in our state. But WSD itself is 134 years old. We are coming up, I should say. Our birthday is in February. And we are very proud to be a part of the historic fabric in this area. In fact, I was rather disappointed last year when there was a study that came out that said our site was actually not the site of the original fort. Because I include that on my tour when I give people a tour of our school. But regardless, WSD is a safe haven for many of the deaf community in Southwest Washington as well as the Portland area. It is home to many, many deaf people. I work very hard to have a sense of safety because our students and staff that work there, everybody signs, and it's access for everybody there. And once they leave, they are back in the real world where not everybody signs and they don't have access. So it is a very special place to many people. So while we are proud of the legacy that continues to be passed on to new generations, our buildings are aging. Our most new building was constructed in 2009, and that is our cafeteria. We did remodel our auditorium in 2011, but we have not had a new school building since 1960. When that building was built, it was really only intended to have a lifespan of 30 years at that time. So I have the things that keep me awake at night are that some of our buildings are no longer earthquake safe. Some of our buildings we do not use. I will let Keith kind of go into that a little bit more in detail. But again, thank you for letting us share our story.
Great. Again, my name is Keith Schreiber, a principal with Schreiber Starling Whitehead Architects. What I'd like to do is explain a little bit about what makes deaf education unique and how the facilities that support this need need to be developed in order to create that unique learning environment for students that have sensory issues so that they can learn effectively and have access to the same education opportunity that all youth in our state have. I will say that this is not the first time this concept of revitalization of the State School for the Deaf has been before you. The project was submitted in 2008, both to this organization and to DAP, and an MOU was actually developed at that time. The first stage of that project was the Castile Hall, Deer Hall replacement, which was done in 2009. However, in our revitalizing the project, we found out that the MOU was never finalized. And so what we need to do now is to rectify that situation and to inform you as the project has changed slightly from the original MOU and concept for a facility master plan. So the things that make deaf education a unique purpose-developed space is that the students really require a lot of sensory reach, and both visually as well as primarily visually, but also physically. Mobility and proximity become much more important in the learning environment for deaf students, deaf and hard of hearing. The space and proximity for how they move through the facility is a safety issue that is unique to this type of learning. And acoustics, light, and color are important in every learning environment, but even more so when you have issues related to either deafness or hard of hearing. So what we need to do is remove obstacles and reinforce visual connections, eliminate those sensory distractions, and increase the student's spatial awareness as they move through the space, and ensure that clear emergency communication occurs. Now, we talk about that as being in the classroom, but really, we've been looking at this as a whole campus and how the campus functions in support of the safety and the efficacy of the learning that goes on within there. So we look at the classrooms, we look at corridors and the physical education components that need to be available for the population that are served at the State School for the Deaf. The project goals that we have begin with the concept of equity. We really feel like it is important to take this opportunity to identify and eliminate physical barriers within the campus of the WSD to allow for the configuration, the flexibility of the facilities to ensure that WSD students have equal access to that effective learning environment and the physical education, which is marginally available now. So as you saw in the earlier pictures, and I'll orient you here real quickly, This is north, and so the way the campus is currently organized is that the heart of the campus is where the old boiler plant used to be, because in the 1910s we put them in the middle of the campus, and everything radiates around there. The high school is located in the corner of this northwest corner of the campus, Epperson Vocational and Middle School. This building is currently vacant, as is the maintenance building, the old dining and cafeteria, and the boiler plant. The Clark Hall, which is an academic and residential space, is located to the western side of the campus. There are residential cottages that support students of every age on campus, as well as north of Paul on the side. So you can kind of see the zoning of the campus. It has an open green area, but mostly this side has parking. The proposed functional zoning to this side indicates that we'll keep the residential zone where the cottages are, because they are some of the newest areas. We really wanted to create, for that circulation space, that academic and cultural core at the center of the campus, where the students really don't have to traverse from one side of the campus to the other side of the campus in order to have access to the educational facilities, such as the library, the physical fitness area, those components which now are located in the periphery of campus. And the students need to basically walk through what has become over time the abandoned part of the center of campus. So the safety of those and removing those unsafe and unoccupied buildings, yes, we have looked at whether they could be reused. Part of the issue that you'll see is the size of the building and the configuration of the buildings really don't support the concept of deaf education, and they really aren't appropriately sized to what we need to be able to create what is, in essence, a pre-K through high school facility in a single academic core. So that's the when we've looked at, let me advance this again, when we looked at what is really driving part of that decision is not just the difficulty of making the physical geometry and the location of the campus develop, but the aging and ineffective facilities. The basic infrastructure of the campus over time has never been developed with facility growth in mind, and so for instance, the boiler plant has been abandoned now for well over 20 years, and it's not only is it seismically unsafe, it has gravity load issues that we need to make sure students aren't nearby, because that building can't really is literally falling apart and has been for about the last decade. So we have those configuration issues, the structural weakness. We also have a considerable amount of hazardous materials in the building, which we need to remove the material and some of the structure in order to get to that, because they're in underground utilities and they come up through the building into the spaces, primarily old heating and boiler insulation. Also, the buildings really have some other facility issues to it related to the energy efficiency and their electrical systems. So in this next phase, the buildings that that are affected, as I mentioned, is the old boiler house located here. It is an unreinforced masonry building that has two abandoned boilers inside. You can see from the historic, there used to be a big chimney next to it. It's been removed. Actually, it removed itself, mostly, and then it was subsequently removed about, I think, 15 years ago. The old kitchen and dining area is really one of the buildings that has the most, outside of the boiler building, the most hazardous materials within it. Because it's located adjacent to the boiler building, its subterranean area or sub area is really filled with asbestos-containing material that we're actually finding up in the air of the space above. It's part of the reason why the first phase of the building was to replace the dining and cafeteria, because this building was such a hazard, we felt, to the students. The maintenance storage building, which you see on the end, is one of the older buildings on campus, or at least the western part of it is. It was, we think, originally in the 1910s as near as we can tell, an old mule barn. And it subsequently has been added to over the years and now basically contains surplus material.
It does look
just like the meal barns in the West Barracks. Mm-hmm.
Yes, it's very similar to that, and it is cast in place concrete for its first 28 feet, and then it switches to unreinforced masonry, and then it switches to concrete blocks. So you can literally see the decades that it's been expanded to over the years. The Epperson Building, let me go back here, right here, is an early 1950s building that is precast concrete with some wood framing for second and third floors. This building also has become unusable to the facility and has been abandoned now for, I think, almost 10 years.
Over 10 years.
It's currently used by the city police department to train SWAT teams for active shooter drills. So it is doing some service. And then these removal of these four buildings come in the first phase of our project, and I'll explain how those phases work. And then the Hunter Gym and Divine School. Divine School was built in the early 60s. It's a wood-framed, almost a modular building. Hunter Gym, originally constructed in the early 30s, is about a 7,000 square foot gym, and we're really in need of almost a 20,000 square foot facility in order to accommodate the growth of the school that's occurred over that period of time. So when we look at the concept now from that zoning, you can see that what we're really looking at doing is maintaining certainly Northrop Hall, which we think is also a wonderful building that can continue to serve primarily in the elementary grades. But the main focus of this is to develop and bring from the perimeter of the campus to the center that main academic core for the building. It will be built around a multi-story building that provides classrooms for elementary through 12th grade. It'll have also the services that the students need to be successful, such as counseling, tutoring, and the unique things related to deaf education, such as accommodation within what we call ASL as a second language. That's really the core basis of the academic strength of the campus. And so the other thing that happens is when Epperson was put in, the main physical ed field for the other students, the non-athletic students, was taken away. And so the K-12 in particular has lost that ability to have physical education immediately adjacent to their academic and learning space. And by replacing that parking lot area with a play field, we really will bring that ability to, again, create equity for these students in the campus they live in, as well as almost recreating what was there in the 1920s. And we'll, by being able to do that, we'll then take the cars all the way to the perimeter of the site, which is, again, from the safety part of the students, the optimum place for them to have. You can see how this might have developed now into a building concept with the new Castell Hall. We say new, but almost 10 years old now. But that dining cafeteria really links into the potential new building so that the students, once they're in this academic and cultural core, can remain there and can access everything that they need in that new facility. So where are we with this project? You can see here that we've looked at the initial phase of the building will be to open that middle part of the site to enable the new building to be built while keeping the Divine School and Hunter in operation, so that we can do this new building without any operational impact to the current functioning of the school. So no students will be displaced. They may be inconvenienced a little bit, but we'll make sure that they have a safe access to it. But by phasing the building, by initially replacing these four buildings with the new core academic center, that will enable that to be constructed with the functions moving into that building and these being removed to allow for the subsequent replacement of the parking and that playfield area. So we're looking at, we now are in January of 2020, we're very happy that this initial phase of the project was included in the governor's supplemental budget for 2020, and the subsequent phases will be in the next biennium funding for 2023 to 2025. And so we're looking at the initial phase before that budget gets released, completing and reinstituting the MOU that was never fully completed in 08, and then beginning the design for phase one and the construction of that, basically preparing the site to be complete by June of 2021, and the phase two design and construction overlap that, so that we see that the phase two construction here will be complete in 2023, allow us to relocate over the summer of 2023 and have the new building operational in the fall of 2023 with the that play field area and the new parking area coming into effect in 2024. So that is a little bit about what's unique about the school, what we've done in terms of investigating the existing conditions to determine how well they can support that goal, that vision of both equity and effectiveness within the uniqueness of deaf education, and how we've laid the project out over scope. And we're, again, really excited that we've finally have seen a funding source to allow for this to occur, considering that it's been about 15 years in the making. So that concludes my formal part of the presentation, and I'll let her say the rest. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. Does the commission have any questions or anything like that? I have one question. Is all the funding coming from state sources? Is there any federal funding at all?
At this point, all of the funding is coming from the state sources under the obligation for community education for K-12. Okay. It's different than K-12 funding, though. It is a separate legislative funding. It is not operated through the Superintendent of Public Instruction, which makes it it's very unique. It's very unique in many ways, but that's one of the ways that being able to jump that bridge and actually get the funding source begun with this first phase has been really a struggle, but we're happy to now see that there's that shared vision is occurring beyond the borders of the campus and looking into the legislature.
How many students are there at the school?
Enrollment right now is about 126 students, and we actually serve students preschool all the way through age 24 because we do have a post-high school program. So we are preschool through 12th grade, and then we have a small post-high school program called Washington Career Academy for the Deaf. And that's for students that have graduated and have exited special education.
Where are the students all local to this part of the state, or where do they? I see you have residential. I wonder what.
Right, correct. We serve students all across the state of Washington. So, and that is kind of why we're a line item in the governor's budget, because we don't get levy dollars because our students are throughout the state of Washington. So we serve students as far east as Spokane, and some of our students come from Bellingham. We provide transportation for those students. Those students live on campus Sunday through Friday. We also serve students that are local, though, too. So it's interesting because we are almost like two schools, elementary and secondary, 7th through 12th, on one campus. Most of our elementary students are local, and then most of our residential and most of our secondary students are residential.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
How far along is the MOU?
We had thought it was complete, so we were surprised when we found out that it wasn't. So we're just now in the process of beginning the redevelopment of that. We have completed two major parts of it that weren't completed previously. And I think that does inform a little bit better to what the original MOU was. One of the things was is that in this last funding cycle, the state did fund a really detailed study of the buildings, so we were able to investigate everything from where the utilities on campus are, because basically as a mystery over time. And what we really found was that as the campus grew over time, this hub that began out of this old boiler building was never replaced. So new buildings were just attached to it. So everything feeds through these older buildings. And so it's really critical to be able to put in new infrastructure to address the fact that, well, we can't just remove the building and not have these other buildings function. So what was thought to be a relatively simple removal and replacement in the initial MOU is really pretty complex. That first phase is nearly $5 million in funds just to make the site available for that vision. So that's the part we're going to update with DAP, and to we anticipate that it's really an update, not a entire revision to it, because of what was agreed to in the initial MOU is still agreed to, and we really want to be able to take components of the building. The buildings aren't really suitable for reuse, but there are some good things about them that we do want to reuse in the new projects. Everything from materials, we think that some of the timber in the Epperson building can be reused in the new building and expressed and celebrated as part of that project, that there's an informational component. One of the things that the campus has, it's again unique to itself, is it has its own museum, and it's in the Northup building. We want to make sure that the information that we've developed on the history of these buildings and the history of the campus get incorporated and celebrated in that museum as well. So those components, I think, are still really key to having the MOU make sense to the students that are going to come here and learn for the next 50 years.
I'm curious if the Preservation Commission is an interested party in that MOU. Usually MOUs are for the federal process, and so if this is all state funding, I'm curious, you know, what regulatory hook, I mean, is it SEPA or EO-0505 that is spurring DAP's involvement and, in developing an MOU, one of the early steps is identifying the interested parties. And we have been signatories to MOUs in the past, and I don't know if that's something that the commission would be interested in. But the fact that you're presenting to us, and you know, I think there are probably folks who are very interested in this project here on this commission, that you know, we may be interested in.
I think that's one of the things that we can do, and when we initially meet with DAP, and we actually have already, and so that's why we've structured this way to revisit the original MOU and basically complete that with the new information we have. What's requiring the MOU is that the state funding of projects over a certain age over a certain size of funding on buildings that are of a certain age are automatically reviewed by DAP as part of that funding approval process. So we've provided them with all of the studies that we've done subsequently, and that's where we found out that the original MOU wasn't actually completed. But it does give us an opportunity to do that. I think in the original MOU that this project was presented to this commission, and I don't think it was as an interested party like you would be in the federal component of that. But it was done as a informational courtesy and an ability to put input within the process. So a little bit more informal because of non-federal,
right,
but still part of what we think is important for the process.
So it sounds like you want to take down four buildings in this initial phase?
Initially, there will be the four buildings that will be removed. It is the old boiler plant, the original cafeteria and dining hall, the maintenance and storage building, and the Epperson School. by removing those four, it allows us to build the new building and redo all of the utilities to allow that to occur.
So my question is, on those buildings, some of those buildings are pretty old and have been around a long time. So what sort of document, do you have some documentation on those buildings that you plan, if you take them down, some documentation and some that you're going to keep to kind of have a history of what was there?
We have so as part of the original MOU, all those buildings were inventoried. The history of them was documented. It was actually provided to the, I can't remember if it was to the Historical Society or to the county. So that information will be provided again. And all of the information that we've been able to gather, some of the older drawings, will also be included and be part of the museum collection that is at the is on campus at that site as well. And copies of that can be available.
So that documentation, is that they came in and did new documentation? I've seen the DAP record on the site, and it's kind of thin.
Mm-hmm.
So is there something more than that? Because maybe I only saw a piece. I mean, there's a brief history of each building, but there's no physical documentation of the buildings. Has that been done?
I think the physical documentation in terms of their existing condition certainly has been done, and that's new information that will be provided. Archaeological Associates, who were the consultant on the original MOU, also provided they provided the site documentation. The inventory that they also did for the original MOU may not be in that site report that you had.
Yeah, I've seen a report. I just don't know which
one. Yeah, I don't think it's that one. So, yes, all that information will be part and parcel of the new MOU and documentation going forward, both to DAP as well as on campus.
And then I'm curious, you know, you've got one conceptual plan for the site that looks pretty well thought out. Did you go through during the planning stages any other kind of iterations where you started to look at ways to potentially save some of the historic buildings? You know, can we overlay the program in such a way on the buildings? Did you go through any of those iterations?
Under the initial pre-design, another architectural firm had done that.
Mm-hmm.
So they did lay the program out over the existing buildings, and that led to the earlier decision to look at a core campus concept. We also looked at what is in the funding part of the process that we go through with the project in the state. We looked at everything from what would it cost us to rent the equivalent space nearby, or what would it cost us to build a new building on a different site, so that we could do. So we did evaluate all of those, both from a cost and an operational standpoint, and the life cycle cost evaluation did indicate the preferred solution as the optimal for the state going forward. So we did evaluate those options.
So they overlaid the program on all the existing buildings?
Yes.
And I guess what I'm asking is more of a selective demolition approach. You know, are there any of the buildings that exist that, you know, could be incorporated reasonably into the current program? Because, you know, I do understand about the curriculum and this, you know, the needs, and a school needs to be a school. You know? But, you know, whether there are pieces of that program and maybe pieces of the existing buildings that might be able to be preserved, I'm just, you know, whether it was looked at that way.
Graphically, I believe so, in terms of the sizing of how they fit within the building, and certainly the first four buildings they're just geometrically not able to provide a classroom of 40 by 40 with an associated corridor and those elements that we need to be able to provide, not without significantly altering them such that any bit of value would be lost. I think the only building that might fall in that would be the Divine School, and that's the least historic of them, unfortunately. It's the wood-framed, single, modularized school that really doesn't have any value for us and would require such a significant upgrade that from a cost basis, it made no sense to pursue that as a saving element. In looking at the need to increase the Hunter gym by almost twice its size, again, that the building is significantly structurally weak right now, and we felt that even though because it has to be a big volume space, it would be hard to double its size without putting in some pretty massive shear walls that would impact its ability to be a big open gym space. It is one of the things that the campus currently lacks, other than the auditorium, is the big gathering space that allows for the school-wide community gathering. And I think that was the thing that we felt would be lost if we tried to expand the Hunter gym to twice its size. So I do think that there are subcomponents, again, within the buildings that we've committed to reuse within the existing building and to feature and create a teaching tool out of those pieces that bring the history of that campus to the future students. And I think that certainly both materials and some of the detailing within the older buildings themselves have the opportunity to do that, such as using perhaps some of the terracotta trim pieces off of the cafeteria building as landscape seating, or so that the students can touch them, doing that with the wood that's in some of the, as I mentioned, in the Epperson building, the large structural beams. Perhaps they can be stairs within the new building. We can create those as the stair treads, and give the information to how it was used.
There's still the possibility that school sits on an archaeological
yes.
site, despite recent findings, but. Has there been archaeological work already done associated with this?
Yes, there have been twice, I think, there have been digs on the campus. Tribes have already been notified, and there's the archaeological report indicated that it's little chance of significant archaeological artifacts as part of the...
I should know this, but I don't right now. was it a campus-wide survey, or was it specific for a certain project at that time?
I believe it was campus-wide. I actually have a copy of it. But
I know it was Castell, where Castell is, our new cafeteria, for sure. It was there when the cottages were built in 1996, when they were finished construction. It was there, so that's on... was at the south side and then the east side. So those two areas were pretty extensively
surveyed. Yeah.
Next, I imagine it's been in use as a school for so long. There may not be a lot of preschool. before the school use, there may be a low chance for archaeological. But of your own history, I imagine there's quite a bit of potential, knowing what residential schools are like and children are like. as you go about work, I imagine you'll be finding quite a bit.
I was really impressed by the museum that they've developed, that their alumni have developed. Yeah, that's in the north, the second floor north of. In addition to that, they really have celebrated at the halls of Clark Hall, have the old photographs and the development of the original Clark Hall. And there, it's just right there, which I don't find in a lot of other schools, because perhaps the students are a little bit more transitory or have a more ephemeral.
Have any of you been to Washington School for the Deaf, our campus? I would invite.
I took ASL there.
So. Oh, you did. Yeah. Awesome. Well, I invite you to come. I am more than willing to give tours. I love to show off WSD. And like I said, the alumni is very strong. And if there is anyone that is looking out for the protection and preservation of meaningful things on that campus. It is the alumni. They have already asked me things like, can they save a brick from the cafeteria? So we would be very interested in getting advice on the things that we can save and incorporate into the new building. I know that other schools for the deaf have done things like that. So it is. The alumni in our community about that school feel so strongly because that it is their home for many of them. And so while they feel protective about it, they also recognize that many of these buildings are just plain no good anymore. Epperson is on this, on that front of Evergreen, and I feel like it's almost an eyesore. And people don't realize, but you come out back to the back part of our campus where the cottages are, we have a beautiful landscape, but nobody can see that because Epperson is falling apart quite literally. So it is both a source of pride and a source of pain for many of our alumni to drive by and see Epperson there. So we would really like to open up the campus. I think that it could be something that our community could be proud of.
Yeah, you asked if any of us on the commission had visited the campus, and over the years that I've lived here in Vancouver and Clark County, many times actually, and once was a memorable visit, including a tour where we had a relative from overseas with a young hearing impaired child, and they were curious about the process and the education process, and knowing that Vancouver had a school for the hearing impaired, we arranged to visit the campus and have a tour. And the school was very gracious. This was many years ago, and have visited the campus for community events and including some architectural work in the past. But the school for the deaf is a really amazing amenity to Clark County and City of Vancouver and the state of Washington, and I think City of Vancouver is very proud to be hosting the school. Appreciated the presentation on the design work. It's great to see progress being made there. I think Alex kind of hit the concerns. We are developing as a commission, I think we're developing some a little better understanding of how to deal with buildings that are being demolished that have some significance in the community. And it will be of interest to us, I think, to see that MOU and see how it's being dealt with, and look at that in light of other structures that are coming up. So I'm not sure officially how the board, the commission, interacts on that MOU, but I think it's a valid thing for us to be taking an interest in.
Well, I mean, could we request to be considered an interested party? I mean, I know it's not a federal process, but, you know, if we could be included in on drafts of the MOU, or because you know, a lot of times there are many drafts of MOUs before they're finalized. I know that you guys are working with a document that's hopefully largely there. So, you know, maybe there's something already that we could look at and give our two cents if there was, you know, anything that stuck out to us. I mean, again, as Rock mentioned, we're dealing with some issues right now that this project sort of fits into. One is the demolition process in the county and in the city, and the other is just the development review process and how, you know, what is our role in that, and what can we do when, and, you know, how much influence do we have, and that kind of thing. So I'd be interested in sort of tracking this project along as it goes. You know, I think the school is a really important part of this community, and you know, we want to be a part of it too.
Would you like to speak to that?
I would love it. Can I say that? Yeah, I think the more support that we have for our school, the better. And like I said, we are not looking to, you know, erase things. We are a vital part of this community. I feel our enrollment is growing. I forgot to mention that. You know, just as recently as 5 years ago, our enrollment was at less than 100. And we are continuing to grow, and part of that is because of CDHY, our mothership, as I like to call it, is now referring more students from across the state to our school. So I hope that our enrollment continues to grow. So I think that this is, I want to be something that Vancouver is proud of. Mm-hmm. For sure.
I think that
the answer is yes.
Okay. I think the site, I think, really epitomizes how preservation is often a compromise. So right now, I think one of the really interesting things about that campus is that it's this record of time, because you've accumulated buildings, you know, over time, and so you can go back over 100 years and see as they have accumulated, and so there's a lot of value to that record of time. But now you're facing this situation where the record of your past is standing in the way of being able to have a present. So do we keep the record of the past and lose the actual organization that was using the site because I have to go somewhere else? You know, there's a real tension there. And I think as a commissioner, I would really like to be involved in helping to find those solutions. You know, what can be retained? How can it be retained? As you know, it sounds like you really care about the history, and that's great. And you know, sometimes we lose historic buildings, but sometimes we can find creative ways to save all or part of them. And if there's, you know, ways that we can help with ideas on that, I think that would be, you know, that's our role. And DAP is a great resource, but you know, we have the advantage of being local.
I mean, our alumni museum has done an amazing job with our museum, and I know that they would love to show that off to you. They have done an amazing amount of work all on their own. So, like I said, my offer is open to any of you that would like to come.
We haven't had a tour in quite a while.
Yes. I mean, we need field trips.
We need more field trips.
We really thank you for the opportunity.
Yeah, thank you.
Today and make this presentation for you. It's important for us to make sure that the word of what we found out and what we're doing with it is understood, and that we set a really good foundation so that we can create a space that attracts the more students that are coming and provides what they need for their growth over the next 50 years. Because frankly, we won't get any more funding for another 50 years. We need to make sure that we maximize what we get. So thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay, while we transition, I'm going to fix the iPad. Okay, so everyone, log back in. Okay, looks like you're on.
Okay.
Yep. So, I think, yeah, those were probably all old ones.
Okay.
So from last month.
Okay.
So you want to open new ones.
All right, good. Wait.
Nope.
Okay, you're not on.
You're doomed.
I know. That's okay.
This one's not working.
No, it goes to Google, but it's not going to the homepage. So you try. Safari. Okay, oh, you're not on either. So, well, here's one too. Here's an extra. Here's one. You guys both need one. Oh, you're good. Okay. Can you take that one?
Yeah.
I can do it.
Okay.
Okay. All right. Moving on to old business and updates, we have a City of Vancouver Code Amendments update from Jan Bader.
Yes, love writing code. One of my least favorite things to do. So we are updating the city's historic preservation code, which is actually in three different sections. So this is the big chunk, 17, and there's another reference in under the zoning code that talks about the regulatory committees we have. So it's got the Planning Commission and the Historic Preservation Commission and a couple other that will need to mirror what we put in 17. And then there's the Heritage Overlay Districts. So the main goal of the code update was to make the city's code as consistent as possible with the county code, because it makes it a lot easier for the staff to administer for you guys and for anybody that's coming to try to get a building on the register if it's fairly identical and it's not two different sets of regulations. So I'm not going to walk through the whole code, because it's full of strikeouts and additions, but just know that most of it is aimed at getting it consistent with the county's code. There are a few questions that came up as we were reviewing this. One of them is on page 6, which is, and this is also actually probably more of a question for the county's attorney than it is for you guys, is our law department suggested that rather when we do want to tinker with the membership of the commission, which we've done a few times over the last 10 years, instead of rewriting the code, that maybe that could be done through the interlocal agreement. So I think Jackie is going to check with the county's attorney to see if they would be okay with that.
Wording on that is a little bit weird.
Awkward.
Yes. Maybe the composition of the membership.
Okay.
I like the idea.
It's not the people.
Yeah, right. But yeah, the composition of the membership can be changed by interlocal agreement, or is established by interlocal agreement, something like that. But just membership sounds weird.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Law department.
I've been paying my dues this month.
And I forwarded her the question and have not heard back, but plan to check back in with her this week so that we can move that along.
And then the next question that came up is on page 8. Where it says that members need to be present to vote on an issue, and it is legal to do telephone voting. We've run into this with the city council, where we'll have a council member that's out of town that calls in for the meeting. But the trick is you've got to be able to hear them, and they've got to be able to hear you in order to make it a valid vote. So the law department again asked if we did not want to consider that as an option. So I don't know how you feel about that.
Funny, that came up just this week. Andy wanted to teleconference into the meeting, and we had a little discussion about it and felt like, well, we don't really have a precedent set, and we don't really have that codified anywhere. And to just kind of jump into that without a discussion first might be rash. So
this didn't occur to me, even though I've been involved in having council members call in for items, but again, our law department, when they were reviewing it, said, why didn't you allow, you know, telephone participation?
Would that have to be then synced back to the county ordinance?
Yeah.
If the city allows it?
Is it something you have to have in code?
You don't have to have in code.
Okay. Could it be in the rules and procedures?
The rules and procedures that you will allow members.
And are you considered present then?
Yeah.
If you're literally phoning it in.
It must be allowed under the state public meetings act.
It's allowed under state law.
Yeah.
Spending a lot of my life on conference calls or attending meetings where a lot of people are in person and I'm on the phone because they're all on the East Coast, I think establishing some standards for what counts, you know, as far as that person can hear, can be heard, I think would be a good idea. Because I've participated in a lot of meetings where evidently I was assigned something and I didn't know because that person wasn't near the phone.
Oh, yeah. I mean, he did warn me that in order for this to work, that we have to, you know.
The technology has to be there.
The technology has to work.
Yeah. And that was kind of Sharon's primary concern. She's like, we're not going to have any assistance after 5 o'clock to help with the
technology and we're going to need help, and, you know, just calling in on a phone probably won't be enough.
The whole cell phone on speakerphone on the table does not
with the mic with the, with the microphone pointed down at it.
Do we have a call in here?
He has to set it up, and we did use it for another commission. They had to come in three times to get it working. So when we're doing it after 5 p.m., we won't have that support. So it would be
because conference calls shouldn't be that complex. I mean, I use that.
They shouldn't
do them
be,
all
but
the
they
shouldn't
are.
Be, but you not really. I mean,
this room has gremlins. I think
if we have the capability of doing conference calls, it shouldn't. It should. If we have that ability in this room or in the rooms that we use.
They bring in that triangular thing, and I think it was having a hard time connect. Like, so they, which someone checks it out, and they have to install it into whatever room. I think it was like just making the connection took a few times. I wasn't there, but this is what my coworker, so it's our other commission, and the person, the party that was calling in, also had difficulties hearing. That his opinion was that it seemed like if first, people weren't loud enough, the phone wasn't picking it up, and then it was like quiet or muted. So there were some difficulties in our first kind of go around with it.
We have those conference call phones in every conference room, and they work just fine.
So, yes, there you go.
I think it's just, yeah, maybe it's a matter of practice and also some etiquette that we would all just need to understand what that etiquette is, which is not ruffling the papers in front of the speaker. You know, there's some etiquette that we can just adapt to, but I think it would be nice to have that option, especially if someone's perhaps sick and they're not able to attend, but they want to participate because they know that there's going to be a vote, or there are a lot of different circumstances.
So it sounds like it could go in the rules and procedures. Mm-hmm. It doesn't need to be in the code, but you're open to the concept.
Okay. Well, we'll circle back when we go to finalize. I assume it'll probably go in the bylaws section of your rules and procedures that we're updating. So we'll just make a note to put that in as a new proposal for you all to review when we go back around.
And I think having it in the rules and procedures has the additional advantage of, as we encounter issues, they can be quickly addressed in our rules and procedures.
And other new technology.
Yeah.
Well, right, do four people on a conference call make a quorum?
Yes.
You have to have some rules, I think, how you want to do that.
I mean, would we still need to have at least a quorum in the physical room? I mean, I can now see one person here and a whole bunch of people on a conference call.
Wait a minute. Yeah. You're either in or you're not in. You're either part of the meeting or you're not part of the meeting. So potentially, yeah, you could have eight people and eight speaker phones and you'd have a quorum. And we do that all the time in my company. I mean, we have our board meetings with people all over the country.
But those sorts of things need to be spelled out.
You need to decide that you're going to do it.
Yeah, and you know, you guys aren't probably, you know, Open Meeting Act compliant, concerned with that kind of thing. And, you know, we need to make sure that everything is recorded and audible and available to the public.
The quality of the transmission is important, yeah, sure. But I don't think, if you're going to do it at all, you just go for it. To me, it's binary. You're in or you're out.
Mm-hmm.
Either decide you're not going to do it, or if you're going to do it, it's open to as many people who have to call in as possible.
I
hate to see somebody calling in from Camas, though.
So if they're contagious.
Well, yes, good point.
And our other commission that was kind of going through the same discussion as to whether or not they were going to do it, they had some suggestions as to, like, how many per year, you know, a maximum that you could do it for the year so it doesn't become something that happens a lot. Because you are still a public body, that you have public coming in to speak with you. So kind of putting some parameters on there can help with that.
That all sounds great.
Okay. So the next question is on the next page, page 9, under the educational services. So this has very prescriptive, you will do one of these a quarter. And I kind of softened all that to be more flexible. And then some of the feedback I got from other staff is, why is this in here? Why would you put this in code? Why wouldn't you put it in the interlocal agreement, which is much easier to change, instead of writing into code that these are all the educational activities you're going to participate in? So this is page 9, section D. It says education services.
So on this one, I was thinking that in the code, it should at least have examples in case the interlocal agreement gets changed and lost, and you know, the so that that intent, but then the actual commitments are in the interlocal agreement.
So it could be provide educational services including blah 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 blah.
Such as including but not limited to, you know.
Yeah.
Your standard code language fund.
Okay.
But yeah, I would agree that having that in the interlocal agreement makes sense.
Is everybody else okay with that?
Yes.
Okay.
There's a typo conducting on, under D1.
Oh, yes, there is. Okay. Next one. And please, you know, take this home. If there's other changes you want to propose, please send me an email. I'm trying to think. On page 20, where it talks about how we're notifying property owners, or notifying people of actions that the commission's taking, especially in regard to the Heritage Register. One of the things that's in here is that, which we took out, was that you're going to post something physically on the property. And I checked with Mark and said, are we physically going out and posting on the property when we're considering putting on the Heritage Register? He's like, no.
I've seen other postings, though.
We do. The county does. The
county does. We don't.
In the city of Vancouver, I've seen posting.
Recently?
No, we do post for land use. Yeah, for all land use actions, we'll post.
Land use actions. I think some kind of neighborhood notification. I'm not wedded to one thing or another, but the number of times I've heard from someone, I didn't even know anything was happening.
Yeah, well, so what we put in here is that you notify the applicant's representative, the neighborhood association in which the property is located, and then property owners within a 300 feet of the nominated property, which is ironic because our code for the rest of our stuff says 500 feet, and the county says 300 feet. So we're like, well, that seems like you guys would want the bigger.
We do for outside of the urban area is 500.
Okay.
So in urban areas is 300, outside is 500.
So, I mean, we're fine with leaving this in here, but the question was, do you know, again, from our law department, you know, he was like, so you're proposing to list a house on the historic register. How does that really impact, you know, their neighbors around them?
I think it's a bigger deal with the
demolition
certificates of appropriateness. Yeah. But I think it is for this, because having a listed property does impact the neighbors, you know, from a little bit to a big bit now, you know, depending. But, yeah, I think the neighborhood association is nice, but that depends on how good your neighborhood association
they could,
is.
You could have a really lame one that doesn't pass stuff on.
Yeah. But, yeah, I do think that immediate vicinity notification is generally a good thing that we would want to see in there. The exact number of feet, I have no opinion on that. But
well, in some ways it helps raise awareness of the program to get a notification that your neighbor's considering listing their house or they want to repair their porch or... Okay, so we'll leave that in there.
It could just be a sign as opposed to like a letter. I mean, I'm not saying it needs to be all the above, just something.
Just something?
Mm-hmm.
Let me do put it in the paper.
Yeah.
Something besides the paper. I mean, like, you know, something.
So this is saying we would put it in the paper. Mm-hmm. We would notify the applicant, obviously, the neighborhood association, property owners within a 300-foot radius, and then to anybody that's, you know, signed up as an interested party, which we were just talking about with the School for the Deaf.
Yeah, let's talk about that, because I think posting it is a better option. I think that's a barrier for an applicant to supply us with mailing labels.
Okay.
That's what we make people do.
Oh, okay.
We do it. We do the mailing ourselves, and we post the sign ourselves.
We post it, but we're not going to.
But we don't get the.
Well, we would mail it, but we would get the we would get
the
labels.
They would have to provide the label.
And
the postage.
Right. Not the postage. We do the postage. Oh. The addresses.
We make the applicant give us the address of the.
But we can do that through Maps Online.
Right. We make people do. Well, that's. We make people come through Maps Online or a title company. Yeah. I get that.
The county years ago
We do for certain, not that we don't do it for this, for historic reviews. We do it for land use. The applicant's required to make the sign and do a lot of the noticing, but we,
If there's a sign, the letters are less important.
Okay.
And just generally speaking, I think. I didn't say they're unimportant, less important.
Okay. So on page 23, paragraph B, we've got this really sort of weird paragraph that is not in the county code, is currently in the city code, and we're debating whether we take it out. But then when I talk to Jackie and Sharon, they're like, well, we kind of like that. I find it a little confusing.
What is a potential historic resource? Isn't everything?
This is under...
On 23?
Page 23.
This point B?
Section B.
Well, it talks about the cultural resources inventory, so those that are listed on that.
A little bit confusing. What is it asking them to do?
Yeah, it is confusing. Because cultural resources inventory, as you all know, is from 1999.
Am I looking at the right thing?
There's no specific direction.
Yeah, it is a confusing.
Just says review it.
That needs to be cleaned up somehow. I mean, even the first sentence when it says responsible for review of impacts to potential or existing historic resources, I mean,
What is a potential
historic resource? I mean, every.
So, again, the county doesn't have this, and I'm leaning towards let's just take it out.
So if you want to keep it in, it's listed or determined to be eligible.
Yeah.
Is the wording that you need if you want it. I think.
How does the inventory with that?
The inventory is not a determination of eligibility. That's something that the SHPO does.
So it's
there is another section at the very end here that talks about the cultural resources inventory. And I'm wondering if whatever we're trying to get at in here just needs to be addressed in that other
section. Yeah, I mean, it's almost like two or three different thoughts in that paragraph B that maybe should be split out.
A makes sense as it goes together, but B just does not make sense in with A.
Yeah, that... You could just cross out potential or existing resources entirely.
So let's set that aside for a minute and look at the cultural resources inventory section, which is on 27. So one of the pieces of feedback that I got is on this is considering that the county is responsible for the cultural resources inventory, not the city. Does it make sense just to leave A and B and then C on, which talks about all of the steps you go through to, you know, to list it on the inventory, maybe should just be in the county code because the city's not responsible for the cultural resource inventory. So maybe we just do the first two.
But there are properties within the city that are on
right.
The clerk
but
county.
But the county maintains the inventory for the city and the county. So the only thing this mucks up with is I had added that there's no, you know, it's B says listing on the cultural resources inventory does not result in any regulatory requirements, but then we added that they needed to do photo documentation if they were going to demolish the building. So this is where I put the demolition piece in, and if I take out all the rest of it, then that one doesn't make any sense.
You can put that in B, right? Effective listing on the inventory instead?
What I put was that there's no regulatory requirements if you're on the cultural resources inventory, with the exception of the requirement for photo documentation, which is currently in if you're demolishing the building, we're going to require
D.2 on 28,
yeah,
page 28.
The next page.
Right, and you're concerned about losing that.
Yeah, so if
so
I...
What I'm
because it says no regulatory restrictions, no right. regulatory requirements, but then...
So if you just move that photo documentation requirement
into
B, which kind of seems like where it belongs, effective listing on the inventory, that's an effective listing on the inventory.
We're still trying to figure out, obviously, if you're going to photograph something, where does it, you know, then where does it live? No one's opposed to requiring, you know, older buildings that are being demolished from getting photographed. It's just the question of where do you keep that information.
Mm-hmm. I have a question. This is something we're going to be meeting about next week, but don't properties in the city say they wanted to be on the cultural resource inventory? Isn't the city responsible for its own?
I don't know. Are we?
All I know is that you all have your records.
Okay.
And we have all the other records.
From the city that was done in 2000. They haven't done in 20 years. But if we were to do them again, isn't the city...
But I think that begs the question. I think what the codes are saying, that let's say someone came in and wanted to be on the inventory, it points to the county to submit that form, and that we would add it to the inventory. So
it looks like the Vancouver Municipal Code points to the county.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So that's why we have to. We're going to meet.
And it has. I mean,
talk about this some more, because we're trying to get all our records together again, so that it's people can one day access whatever they want, no matter what jurisdiction it is in. So that's kind of one of the things we're going
to
work
on. I'd like to see some language that says that the cultural resource inventory has to be updated every 5 or 7 or 10 years.
Minimum of every 50 years.
I want to figure out. No, it's been 20 years.
We've I know.
Done twice at 20-year intervals, and now we're at that 20-year interval. What do we do?
So. And then also making it accessible.
Right. Yeah.
I mean, it's like the ghost ship. I've heard about it for years, and I don't really know.
So the county's in the process of digitizing, and then we're going to make all those cultural resource inventory forms from 2000 available on the website, just like the historic nominations are. So we'll have that done by the spring.
Okay.
The city to see if they can do that. That will take care of the old inventory forms, and now we need to figure out what to do to re-update the inventory, to hit some areas that we didn't hit in 2000, to look at some of the mid-century buildings that weren't 50 years old in 2000.
Yeah. And that meeting's happening where and when?
We're meeting next week to talk about it.
We're going to be like, what do you have, and where is it? Because I mean, right now all of ours are in file cabinets, and it's kind of this bizarre way I have to, you know, there's codes and identification numbers that you find on the spreadsheet, and then you got to go dig in the file cabinet to match it. So, like, whenever I get an inquiry, that's how I get it, and I scan it in, and I try to get it so that we have it electronic. But there's lots of these records, and so we are working towards getting them all scanned in, and then the next step would be figuring out how to develop a database that's accessible online. So we're working with our web team on how that would work. So we're
great.
Getting there.
And we thought it made sense, if they're going to have the cultural resource inventory of Clark County online, that as we're digitizing ours, we just give them a copy, and it can
all... You would hold all the records, then. Yeah.
Boy, maybe that's where those photos could be housed, too. The demolition.
Yeah, we just have to find a way to, so it's clear inventory or stock. Yeah.
Something, yeah.
Could be another category.
Right.
I mean, it's an inventory, right? That's all it is. I mean,
But there's a set of criteria for getting on the cultural resources inventory, and we might want to document stuff that doesn't justify inclusion on the on a cultural resources inventory. So I think there would be a need for differentiation. But, yeah, I mean, a system that maps all the sites together and, you know, here's the Clark County Heritage sites, here's the cultural resources inventory site, here's the graveyard of lost buildings.
Anyway, if you have other comments, if I could get them in maybe the next 2 weeks, it would be great. Really like to keep this moving. It was sort of the
in the fall and over the Christmas break project. Mm-hmm.
End of January
would be great.
I did have one question. You said that the regulations are in a couple of places. I know it's come up how we actually give our feedback on the heritage overlay districts, and that we probably need to regularize that a little bit better. I'm reading through this, and it doesn't quite seem like it fits in this.
No, that's in a separate section of the code.
That probably fits over in the other, but.
What's in here on the heritage overlay is essentially the definition of what a heritage overlay district is, and that under the duties of the commission, one of them is to provide advisory review on the heritage overlay district.
So we'll get to that when we get to that one.
Right. So I got that, and I got the one that's got the different regulatory bodies, and I haven't gotten to the heritage overlay district yet. Okay. Anyway, just if you have suggestions, send them to me.
Okay.
Again, most of this is literally county code, city code.
Mm-hmm. Synchronization.
Cross out everything.
All right. Moving along to the City of Vancouver response, and I'm assuming that is to our letter regarding the Academy. And I assume as well that everybody has had a chance to read the City of Vancouver's response. I did get an email from Chad Eichen Monday, hoping to come to the meeting, which he thought was Monday, but he couldn't come to the meeting Monday because he had a city council meeting, and then said, oh, I just realized it's Wednesday. I can't come to that meeting either because I got a West Side Mobility meeting. So
you have to go be on the hot seat on that one.
Yeah. So anyway, I think that gives us the opportunity to discuss the response. I'll open the floor to any commissioners who have thoughts, questions.
I'm going to ask Sean if you want to take it away. Well, I'll just say this. Sean was kind enough to reach out to the subcommittee previously, and I apologize. I didn't get you my comments. But we did put together some talking points.
What?
If you're going to share those. Yes, sorry.
I should say, I put together my thoughts to share with the subcommittee.
I'll take a crack at it. Mine are short. I read Sean's comments and, in general, agreed. I guess I come at it from a slightly different position because I wasn't here when the original review was done. So I'm sitting here looking back and reading the city's response and saying, the way I read it, the city is saying, we gave you a chance to comment. Here's what you actually said. And we addressed what you actually agreed to and moved. And so to me, as I was talking to Alex earlier, I if I were in the city, I'd write the same kind of a letter, frankly. So what it says to me is we have to take our responsibility at the initial meeting a lot more aggressively, let's say, if we can get it. I realize I don't know anything about the commission at that time, what the members felt. But to me, this was a missed opportunity from a commission standpoint, because as we've also discussed, I think the plan development totally dwarfs what everybody acknowledges is perhaps the most important building in Vancouver that's not owned by the federal government today, let's say. So to me, we've lost an opportunity. I think their offer to work with us on code revisions to get maybe more better defined input, if we can get it, is probably important that we should pursue, and just press on and treat this as a lesson learned. That's kind of where I come from on it.
I have not seen your comments.
Oh, that's right. I'm gonna. Okay. I'll give my comments.
Yeah. Okay.
Okay. Okay. So not meaning to disagree that much with you, Sean, but that's sort of what I see.
You know, I agree with you up to a certain point. I think my overall reaction was actually I was rather disappointed in the response. The biggest reason I was disappointed is that the response that we got didn't address any of the substantial points that we made. And that for me was really disappointing. And we gave reasons why we felt that the SEPA process wasn't followed, and the response was we followed it. And we gave reasons why our deliberations were hindered in the first round, and that was glossed over. And I was actually found it a little disturbing that City Planning wasn't more concerned about the fact that their permit was based on inaccurate information. That was a little bit unsettling to me. Generally, I think that's kind of the core of it, is I felt that our substantial comments, there wasn't a response to them. There was one thing that Chad said in the response was, we don't have authority to require a preservation plan or to require listing on the register, and the city does have that authority. It's in the code. Now, whether a particular mitigation measure, they have the authority to require mitigation measures in order for a permit to be granted, and there can be, one of the conditions is that it has to be reasonable. And so, of course, there can be arguments about what is reasonable, but they do have the authority to require mitigation measures. And that was one of the problems, is that they didn't require any of the mitigation measures. So it leaves me, I came out of after the letter even more concerned about City Planning's understanding of its obligations under SEPA than before when we sent our original letter. And so I agree with Don. I think that we need to be looking forward and what we can do to improve the process moving forward, even though, I still see serious flaws in the past that should be very concerning to the community and to anyone in government. I recognize what this town is like, and there might not be anything that happens because of that. I think there's a lot that we can do moving forward that's collaborative and productive, and so I think that we should stick on those. These are still our concerns, and we would like to find ways to address them with projects moving forward.
To me, the issue on SEPA is really an important one. I agree with you. Their reliance on this, what I would call a generic or whatever I don't know what the exact title is, but
sub-area plan.
The reliance on that is adequate is a fundamental issue, a problem, because if I had done an environmental assessment, environmental impact statement on that site as something I was going to build for one of my former employers, let's say, there's no way that I wouldn't have gotten hundreds of comments probably about the mass and scale of the development next to the Academy building. And I would have been expected to respond to those comments and probably look at mitigation measures, as you suggested. They were relying, though, on that sub-agency plan, and that's where the flaw is. That gives them their argument back that we considered SEPA. It's also the flaw in the process that if we can figure out how to address that, maybe we do better going forward on future projects. So I don't think you and I are very much in disagreement. It's a question of what's the best strategy to change this going forward.
I'm going to make a kind of a sidebar comment. I think overall also I was more than disappointed. I was actually a bit disheartened by the letter, because I didn't feel that there was any acknowledgement of the issues in a real genuine way of having read the letter and the impact of the letter. They didn't acknowledge any of the public outcry that we had mentioned, that there was there are a lot of people in our community who have expressed serious concerns about the project, and that wasn't even acknowledged. That was bothersome. I'm not going to touch on all the points you made because you've already made them, and I agree with many of them. But I also felt that there's a bit of a dismissal in that phase two isn't going to involve any impacts
for Evergreen, so it makes me curious. Are they expecting to present to us because it doesn't do that? The way I read it, it just seemed that they were dismissing that there's going to be any problem with phase two, like we presented in our letter for phase one, and that concerned me because obviously we would want to have some buy-in, even though they do say that they're going to, if necessary, they'll bring forward phase two. But it does say our understanding, however, is the second phase will not involve any changes to the south side of the academy building, and because the first phase has been approved, there will not be any further impacts to the view. So
that is an odd statement.
Yeah. Right.
Impacts.
Yeah.
Just
we're just
going
to ignore
right
that. It's the way it is, kind of. So I was a little disheartened. Because I didn't really feel, like you said, that the meat of what we were trying to discuss and bring forward was, in a sense, not seen perhaps as important to them as it was to us.
Yeah, I felt like a lot of the letter kind of put it back in our lap about they wanted more specificity and kind of tried to put the burden back on us. I wasn't surprised by the letter. I thought it was kind of interesting about how they justified what they did, and then there was an acknowledgement that that there's a certain amount of informed judgment and allows for interpretation and exceptions when it comes to historic preservation. And then we would really like you to tell us what to do. Mm-hmm. So, I wasn't surprised by what their response was. I wish that there was more that we could get done along those lines, but maybe, as Don said, we've missed the window on this one. I don't know.
It just scares me that we could always miss the window if we're not given, like you were saying, if we don't even know that we're supposed to be able to respond aggressively because we think there's going to be more discussion in the future, and there is none. You know, it's hard to know, are we missing the window when we come to the meeting? Is it now just moving forward?
So I would always assume the worst.
Yeah.
I would always assume that your first bite might be your only bite.
Yeah, unfortunately, that's kind of the lesson here for us.
Well, when talking to Don before the meeting, it was kind of presented to us as this is the project. It wasn't, and we'll solicit comments on minor suggestions, but it was presented as a done deal to us, and I think that's kind of why our comments got hung up on things like planter sizes and stuff. But my one comment was, in the beginning of the letter, the response, and I got to say, overall, it's what I was kind of expecting, and that there is some, I feel like, some daylight moving forward. That I, there might be a fairly big difference of opinion, but that it seems like there's a tone of collaboration for moving forward. I don't know if it's appropriate for me to read Chad's email to the commission. No? Yes? Yeah, just his email.
No, his email, not his. She thought you meant the letter at first.
No. No. But the other comment that I had on sort of a more negative side was that I felt like he kind of cherry-picked our comments from that meeting.
That was the word that was on my mind as well.
Because I I'll go back and listen to that meeting, but I specifically recall saying, I don't think this meets the heritage overlay language. I have serious concerns about this development, in its essence and its size and everything else. And also said, moving forward, this thing needs a management plan. This property needs a management plan. Otherwise, it's going to be nitpicked and chiseled away until it's just an isolated island of, a diminished building on its own property. So, that wasn't really included in the letter. And
I'll actually go a step further, and this might be why, I thought it was a little bit more negative than Don did. I felt that the letter didn't just cherry-pick our comments. I felt that it misrepresented the feedback that we gave them last year. When we talked about views and expressed concerns about, the view from Evergreen, the letter discussed comments about a different code section, and as if they were to that code section. because there's two places in the code where views are addressed. The staff report was the same thing. There was confusion about this. It's like, there wasn't confusion. You know, we asked for what they thought the interpretation was. I did go back and listen to both meetings when we met with them. The city very much left us with the impression that this would be going through a full SEPA process. Because every time we brought up SEPA review of this, silence. I mean, there was no, you know, we expressed the expectation that this would be going through SEPA, and we were never corrected. But the comments our comments were very much, I felt, misrepresented in both the letter and the staff report. And I felt that some of the comments about historic preservation in the letter were a little bit dismissive of historic preservation. And so I think that's one of the reasons I came away with this negativity, because, you know, like you, I came right out and said, this doesn't meet the code. You know, I do this nationally. I do historic buildings and building codes on a national level. I participate in national conferences, summits. I've written articles. I write codes. It doesn't comply, and I made that very clear at the meeting. And there's, you know, some commissioners thought it complied, and some thought that maybe it didn't. And there's no mention of the fact that every single commissioner raised concerns about the massing and scale. Every single one said that it was inappropriate, and there was no recognition of
that. Is there an issue of how the opinions or comments of the commission are conveyed to the city? Does it need to be done in a more formal way with a written document, or was it?
We gave them a written document.
We did, okay.
And it misrepresents the written document, which is we issued findings, which were really kind of, I don't know if you remember, they're kind of distilled notes of the feedback given by the individual commissioners. I think that you're right. I think this shows that we need to have a much more regular process for giving our feedback that is more forceful and official. And since it is an official action, Alex and I met with the county attorney that we probably should be voting on our feedback and actually, you know, in each case, making it be an official action. So I think that'll help with the...
So that we speak as a commission.
We speak as a commission.
The ability to say, well, some people didn't say that.
Because, I mean, I'll be honest.
That kind of nonsense.
And that we should all sign letters that we're sending to as the whole commission.
Yeah, should all.
We're all in agreement. I know. And looking back after, you know, the Colombian, I was like, Gollin Denison. And just, you know, I would just love to see Historic Preservation Commission, the commission in print rather than my name. So.
Yeah, because in the time that I've been on the commission, I cannot actually think of a single time that the city has taken our advice on anything. If the applicant did, then we had an impact. But any time that we suggested something, and you know that something should happen, or that you know the criteria weren't being met, if the applicant didn't change it themselves, I've not seen a single one be changed. So I think that we do need to be more forceful in how we get the advice. Maybe I'm missing one, but that's...
I have one question. Does this really rest at our doorstep? And what I say is, what I mean by that is, isn't there some responsibility that the city also has to have their own historic preservation lens that they need to also come to the table with so that it's not always on that commission meeting from 2018 to have made those forceful comments? Because as we've seen, if that's the only opportunity, then we're, in a sense, we're the only responsible individuals.
Well, SEPA.
Well, do you know what I'm saying? Yeah. I mean, you get my point.
Yeah.
It's not just our responsibility. It's also the city's responsibility to come through.
I agree with that. I think that was pretty clear in the letter, the response letter, that you know, our opinions, and
there was also an issue, and that's a point, is that we're allowed to comment, they consider our opinions, and then do whatever they choose to do based on those suggestions.
Right.
With no obligation to implement any of them, as I understand our current responsibility.
There's an indirect obligation, since the city code identifies us as the local authorities for historic preservation, but that's not an explicit obligation by any means.
Yeah, and you know, if I had my way, and we'd be the approving authority for any building permit that involved historic property. And then you would have the regulatory teeth to enforce the recommendations we're making.
You'd also have the ability, you know, I think if the city is going to take on the responsibility of being kind of the deciding body on preservation regulations, then that does create that obligation that Julie was asking about. But the reality is that preservation, I'm not going to say it's not an exact science. There is a lot of exactitude toward certain principles of it, and especially the ordinances are laid out quite exactly. But when you're weighing these things, you kind of need a deliberative body. To be doing it as a magisterial approval is not an effective way to enforce preservation regulations. So as you're updating the code.
Mind.
We will.
But I just want to clarify. I don't mean that we're not an important body. I just mean that in the letter and the response, it seemed to me that they were saying, well, you guys didn't say that in that meeting, and that was your chance, and we wipe our hands from it. To me, I also feel they have a responsibility as well to come forward with their own critical thinking, with their own critical way of looking at the development project and how it's going to impact the historic fabric of that property. I don't think it's just on our shoulders to bear that. That's all I was saying.
Well, I think I would like to read Chad's email because it to me sounds more conciliatory, maybe, than Monday.
Okay.
Monday. And the first paragraph just deals with scheduling. I have a meeting and this and that. And I won't be able to attend. But then he says, I know there are significant differences of opinion between city staff and the HPC regarding the approval of the Aegis Phase 1 project. It is my hope that my letter was taken in the spirit that it was intended, which was first to provide an explanation of why staff felt the project would comply with the standards and guidelines of the Heritage Overlay District Number 1, and second, to offer that staff would be willing to discuss needed revisions to the Heritage Overlay District and the Development Code at a series of HPC workshops this year as part of a major update to the Vancouver City Center Vision Plan, which is now more than 10 years old. It is this second area where I hope the HPC will focus their discussion tonight, since the Aegis Phase 1 project has been approved and will likely begin construction this spring. Lastly, it occurs to me that there might also be process-related questions among HPC members, and our planners or attorneys would be willing to provide some training on the land use approval process for downtown projects at one of your workshops this year, if that might also be of interest. Again, please share my apologies with the other commissioners for not being able to attend tonight. Please feel free to contact me if I may be of further assistance.
That first offer sounds great. That second offer is offensive.
I'll pass on.
I think that pursuing ways that we can, collaborate on updating the regulations themselves, I think that that's a great thing. Hopefully we can do that. I think on the CEPA regulations themselves, I have more concerns, not fewer concerns, and I don't believe that city planning can educate us on how CEPA should be run. And so I do have one suggestion moving forward that I think that would be useful. There is a state authority on how CEPA should be run for cultural resources, and that's DAP. And one of the things that they will do is run workshops about how to run the CEPA process for cultural resources. And I think that we should invite DAP down to run the workshop that he's talking about, that DAP should run it, and that city planning should participate in it with us so that we can come to a shared understanding, a shared understanding of the preservation opportunities under CEPA and a shared understanding of the city obligations. And I think if something is, since we do have this strong, I wouldn't say it's a difference of opinion, but since we have this strong difference of viewing what CEPA should look like, that I think it would be most productive to bring in the actual state authority on it so that, we're not just having this kind of back and forth about, we think it means this, we think it means that. No, let's bring in someone who can speak with authority on it and come to that shared understanding of what it requires.
I agree.
Is that
motion worthy?
Was there more discussion on other things?
I don't want this to end up being a pile on, especially, you know, there are no representatives present, and you know, I feel like
Mark have to do that.
Well, I mean, I feel like we've had our chance to air out our, you know, and it could go on, and I don't necessarily want that to happen. So, you know, I'd like to wrap it up, this discussion, if everyone feels like we've covered the essentials.
There is one other thing. I got an email from the Columbian Reporter looking for a comment for their last, mm-hmm. their article about the letter, and I told her, well, I can't comment on behalf of the commission. I said, it's on our agenda, and we could certainly vote to issue a response, or we could vote to nominate a representative to talk to the media, but you know, I can't give you a comment. I don't know what she looks like, but I don't think she's here. I invited her to show up. So I think there is the question of whether we want to comment in any way on
a formal comment.
I do want to note that Councilmember Fox has brought this issue to the mayor's attention, and so the mayor's asked to have a meeting with the planning department to talk about the concerns that have been raised.
So encouraging.
It seems to me that the response to the Columbian is that we are going to discuss with the city their findings and their offer to consult. Mm-hmm. I think we should stop there. I don't think continuing this in the Columbian is going to do either the county commission or the city any good. That's Don Frost's opinion. The second thing, I think we should respond, as you've suggested, first take them up on their offer to work with them. Say we like the idea of a workshop. We think, however, it should be run by DAHB and should be attended by both the city and the county. And I think that should be our response to their letter at this point in time. And if you want a motion that we craft such a letter, I'll so move.
I'll second it so that we can discuss that.
Okay. Let's discuss the motion. I mean, it doesn't have to. I mean, it doesn't have to be too much of a formal letter. I mean, you know, it's a. And then, you know, okay. Well, that's one thing to discuss. So, do you want to formalize that motion?
So I move that the commission send a response to the city, thanking them for their letter. Agreeing that, and thanking them for the opportunity to participate in the workshops, and saying that we desire to, as far as the code revisions, and also suggesting that, in response, is it in the email that he talked about this?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
In response to his email, that we agreed that a workshop on SEPA would be useful, and we think that it should be jointly city planning and County Historic Preservation, but it should be run by DAHB so that we get a uniform statewide view of it. So those are the things for the letter. Now the actual words are drafted.
To be attended by city and county planning.
Yes.
Both, yeah.
And the HPC.
Yes.
His letter is also inviting you to provide comment on the Heritage Overlay section of code?
Yeah, that was the first part. That was the, to revise the Heritage Overlay District 1 language.
The sub-area plan that let some of the steps be skipped.
Mm-hmm.
So maybe the motion should be that we prepare such a letter for review by the commission at our next meeting.
Mm-hmm.
Can I amend my motion?
Public comment, unfortunately, is at the end of the meetings.
Yes.
Unless it's a hearing. Unless it's a hearing.
Yeah.
You can.
We can. We can.
she really wants to comment, I have
yeah.
a problem.
Yeah, okay, we can make an exception and invite a member of the public to comment on this particular subject.
Go ahead and turn on your microphone.
My name is Connie Kearney, and I appreciate you letting me speak to you. I want you to know that my husband and I have known Ed Lynch for years and years and years, and he's gone now, but it was his vision, really, to purchase the academy, and he had quite a vision for the development of it. And my husband and I read both those letters, the letter you all wrote, which I thought was really wonderful, and the letter that came from the city, and I wanted you to know that it seemed to me that August 15th meeting that you were talking about, the proposed buildings, but the whole topic of masks really didn't come up. And then it wasn't till later that you all became more informed about really the mass of those buildings. And then you wrote the letter you wrote. And it seems like the city recognized the deficiencies of the rules in the process, and they really made poor excuses for saying why they approved a poor plan. But to our point of view, the impact is tremendous on the academy and what's, you know, the most important building in the state of Washington. And I wanted you to know that I was told, this was given to me by a friend, but I was told that the Lady of Lourdes Church session on Sunday, that this was handed out and asking the parishioners to sign it and send it into the city. It seems like you should be aware of that. I wasn't at the church service where it was presented, but there's a lot of people that are very, very concerned about what's happening, and it seems like you all are the best bastion to say, wait a minute, I mean, it isn't being preserved. It's being enveloped by commercial multi-use development. So, I mean, I heard your comments about, you know, next step and what we do in the future, but it seems like somehow I would urge you as a body to take, I mean, maybe it's legal action or maybe there's some way that you can get attention and have them back off about this massive development. So good luck, but thank you for listening to me.
Thank you for your
comments.
Where were we? Making a motion? Discussing a motion?
Discussing a motion. I think I like Don's idea. You know, I like the idea of, you know, putting something together and then we can bring it back to the commission. I think that one step that I would actually like to see is maybe we could just go ahead and decide to invite DAP down and we could go through a workshop on SEPA and then we could invite everyone else to attend, you know, because I think that we've got this understanding of what the process should entail, and you know, it'd be great, since someone disagrees with us, well, let's have the statewide expert come down, and I'd like that workshop to happen,
yeah,
regardless of whether or not.
But I do think that, I mean, SEPA is a tricky thing because it every jurisdiction can interpret it the way they want, to a degree, and so you have these kinds of things like this planned area action things, you know. You know, I mean, the county, I'm most familiar with the county's, you know, SEPA and county decisions. But it's very much a jurisdictional specific kind of thing. So I would want to make sure that the city feels invested in whatever, you know, I want there to be collaboration, you know, a sense of collaboration moving forward with the city. I don't want an alienation sense about this. So you know, if the city is willing to set something up, I think it would be good for us to suggest or insist that DAP perhaps attend or run it. But just having DAP and us doing the inviting may result in the city being like, but, you know, and then they're like, well, we have our process and our codes, and, you know, we want to discuss them with you, and you're going a different direction.
You know, I understand that specifically. I think, honestly, I have no interest in attending a workshop that's run by the city. You know, after I've, because I have read through the city's version of SEPA, and it's quite clear, and you know, I think the deficiencies are quite clear as well. And so, I have no interest in learning that interpretation of those code provisions. I think, you know, phrasing it in a different way, that's, yes, we think that's a great idea, and we'd like to invite DAP to run it. I'm fine with that. If it's not run by DAP, I don't see it as serving any purpose at all. I don't think that that's collaborative. I don't think it'd be productive.
But as Alex was saying, was putting the idea out there that DAP runs it, just putting it out there, making that suggestion. And see how they respond. Mm-hmm. Just see how they respond. Just kind of be kind of relaxed about it, and then go from there once their response. Find out what their response is.
Yeah, I think that, you know, from a process standpoint, that's fine. I don't have any issue with that.
Anybody else?
I agree that with the motion as stated, and I think we need to tread a little carefully as far as you said, Alex, maintaining a spirit of collaboration and cooperation on this, because, you know, we're all kind of rowing the same boat here.
Mm-hmm.
I think it would be valuable to us as commissioners to hear how the state runs their SEPA process. And it would be, you know, maybe even more valuable to planning for the city and county, because you can tend to drill into your own pool and lose sight of some essentials that when you're inwardly focused on your own processes. So it could be very valuable.
Well, and there's also, you know, I think it's important to keep in mind the way that the state SEPA Act is written, it obligates jurisdictions to adopt certain regulations as part of SEPA and do certain things, and then it's got this kind of outside of that optional, cities can adopt these parts. So there is a certain amount of consistency across jurisdictions that, you know, every jurisdiction has to do this. These thresholds cover these things. Well, that's in the state in the state legislation, and so that variability between the different jurisdictions is real, but there is also a very substantial similarity between all of them, and I think that that's something that DAP can speak to, and, you know, they've got the. They have the expertise to then look at, you know, Vancouver's code and Clark County's code and see, oh, here's the way, you know, they did these optional ones and they did these optional ones.
I think we all agree that it would be helpful to collaborate with them and to offer up a neutral ground, which would be DAP being the facilitator and offering that as, you know, an olive branch, I guess you can say, like, yeah, we both think that this would be a great thing for the commission and for the planners, and how about we have DAP, yeah. You know, and I think that any, I think reasonably they would, sounds like, would be receptive to that. So I think we're all in agreement.
So the idea is that we draft some sort of a letter, and we at the next meeting we look at the letter and approve the letter and then send that out. That's the way we're going.
So I think if there's, Don included two main points to cover in the letter. So I think if anyone thinks anything else should be covered, or that it shouldn't be, or that this is the wrong idea, you know, We can amend the motion for additional points if anything, if anyone thinks anything else needs to be added.
Can the Academy subcommittee, it's still active, right?
It's still active.
So, just for the sake of consistency, would you guys be willing to craft this response to the response?
Yes, I'm
willing.
Can you share your email though, because it's in a sense a direct response to your his email, because he
yes.
proposes.
Yes, I will send it to Sharon, who can send it.
Chad's email, I have it.
You have it.
You can forward it to the
subcommittee. Yeah.
And I guess my other question is, do we need a formal letter? Can it not just simply be a response from you saying we discussed this at the meeting and this is what we're proposing? What do you think? Or does it need to be?
The response could be an email. I mean, in some ways now we're responding to his email, not to the letter itself.
I think it's fine that it's an email. I think that it should still be public in some way, because there have been a lot of questions about what is your response? What are you going to do about it? And so I think that.
And I haven't written back to him. I've been in the field all week.
So I agree with Don. It's not a response we give to the Columbian, but I think it is one that we want to make readily available to the public.
And
the same way that our other letter was, and even if it's just here's the email we sent.
And Alex, you brought up a good point earlier about communications being from commission versus being from an individual on the commission, and you're feeling a little discomfort in having your name as the signatory on that letter. So I don't know if this would be from.
Well, it's mainly because I want the Historic Preservation Commission to be identified. I mean, we have a very low profile, and any chance we have to raise our profile, and this was a really good chance. And instead, the article kept saying Gall and Dennison, when I really wish it had said the commission, the Historic Preservation Commission. And not only that, but it would have kind of hammered home the point that we were unanimous in writing this letter. It wasn't the chair and co-chair off on the side writing a letter, and the rest of the commission wasn't in agreement or something. It just didn't. By not all of us signing it, it didn't present the unified voice that I.
Well, there's a good example right over there on that wall.
Yeah.
There you go.
All the signatures.
Yeah, but I want to remind you one thing. It was essentially written by one person. or we would probably still be a part of the United Kingdom. But anyway, well, we can do it as a subcommittee.
Okay.
Vote on the motion.
Yeah, vote on the motion too.
Jackie looks like she wants to.
Is this coming back to you next month? Are you voting a motion to have the subcommittee draft it and someone to send it and not coming back next month?
We want the whole commission to approve it, so I think it has to come
back. Okay. I was unclear there.
All right.
I want to make sure I get the motion right here.
Yeah. Okay, and just. For clarification, if you're sending it to Chad and not to the entire city council, it won't be picked up by the Columbian. So you guys will have to send it to the Columbian if you want it to go there.
I think that we should copy the city council on it. And I think that, they're the ones that we addressed with our original letter to start with. I don't think that they should be out of the loop on this at all.
And if the mayor has taken an interest and wants to stay informed, then... And there's at least one other commissioner that's interested. I don't see why we wouldn't.
It's fine. I just wanted to make that point that if you're just sending it to Chad,
his
mail doesn't go to the Columbian.
Would it be appropriate?
Fascinating, I'm sure.
Given that we wrote the city and he responded, would it not be appropriate to copy all the mayor and the
I think it's fine. You just send it back to him with a copy to the,
to
the mayor and the council. But
okay. We'll all sign.
So maybe in the meantime, I'll just write back to Chad, in terms of just email etiquette, to say thanks for your comments, and we look forward, we're preparing a response, and we look forward to working together in the future.
So I'd like to offer a friendly amendment to your motion that it includes doing that, because
sure.
I'll be in front of my computer tomorrow morning. So.
Go for it. I agree. Amendment accepted.
Okay.
We vote?
Are we ready to vote? I mean, I don't think we could re-verbalize the whole motion.
I don't think we need to.
Okay. So, all in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. Any opposed? So moved. All right. Well, new business. We're a little behind schedule. I had a feeling I had a feeling this was going to be a long meeting.
This will be quick.
For the record, I think we ought to postpone the demolition discussion, the demolition subcommittee discussion for next meeting. Sean, you okay with that? I know you worked hard. We revised a letter, and maybe it would make sense to send it out to the commission ahead of time so that people have time to digest and come back to it.
I think just point out the one thing is that there's a highlighted section, and that's what's different than what we shared before.
Okay.
It is substantially the same, and there's a key difference that's identified in the content. So we would love, and I think speaking, speaking for the subcommittee, I think we see this as a beginning point of a conversation, not as a, this is what we recommend the commission do. Mm-hmm. This is our recommendation for starting the conversation.
Okay, Clark County Courthouse, new front signage request for HPC comment. Jackie?
So this should be quick. The courthouse is on the National Register, so you all don't have any review authority over it, but it did come to me as just checking in. So it's just kind of a cursory kind of review by you all to see if you have any comments to share with the county. Courthouse staff are trying to make it more visible. So the current sign that you see on that memo is the one on the left that's a little tan. And they're just trying to the size and the font looks like it's all going to be the same. They're just making the background black and font white. So just because I want to make sure that they still afford us, inquiries, I suggested I just run it by you all just as a courtesy. Any concerns? Any feedback you want me to share with them?
Anything easier to read for somebody driving by is a good thing for public safety, if no other reason.
Mm-hmm. And it looks like it brings them more into compliance with the Americans.
Probably, yep. Okay.
And the old one's from 1980s, yep. So it's not like we're...
Yeah, white on light gray. Who thought of that?
Maybe...
Yes.
Thank them. We appreciate the opportunity to get feedback.
Will do. Okay, see, that was quick.
Yeah. All right. The Sarah store.
Yesterday I received an email forwarded to you all from a realtor or broker that's, working with the property owner. Sounds like the property is going to go into foreclosure. So it's on the local register and the national register of historic places. It was the general store post office for the enclave of Sarah. And it's probably the last remaining kind of structure of that community. It's got some serious issues and disrepair because of some of environmental issues that have occurred on the site over the years through development of roads and just development of the area. So they've got some water issues underneath on the ground. So the realtor or the broker, he's kind of just wanting to know what should they do? What are they, whoever owns it or buys it, if it's so bad, far shape, what's the processes that would kick in because it's on the register? And now I'm getting all kinds of calls from realtors because apparently now my name's on the RMLS to contact me. to ask questions. So they are, and there seems to be a lot of interest because a lot of realtors are calling me and being like, so what can we do with this? Like, what's allowed? And there's a lot of land use questions, like, can we make it just residence? And so I told them that, you know, I explained that I'm the historic side of it. I'll explain to you what you can and cannot do or what the rules are for the structure, but what you do inside of it as a use is another question, is another department. So sounds like maybe, you know, someone might be interested in purchasing it, but we're still going to get questions as to, you know, what you do with a building that's this far gone. So we just wanted to kind of give you a heads up, see if you wanted to go visit it. That was a suggestion from the broker. You don't necessarily have to go as a group. You could just go on your own time to check it out. But it may be starting to start thinking about that building and potential reviews coming before you, albeit if it's a certificate of appropriateness or, you know, unfortunately, maybe a waiver of a certificate of appropriateness. So just wanted to share that's coming, that came across.
Is this the listing broker that's involved in
Yes.
cleansing?
Mm-hmm.
So if we want to get inside, we should call him.
Yes. And I told him that since I was meeting, you all were meeting tonight, that I would bring it forward to see if you had any initial feedback or any comments. I don't expect you to, unless you do, but that's kind of where we are.
It's a shame it's fallen into such disrepair.
Yes.
It was in disrepair when it was listed.
Was it?
Yes.
And it's still gotten worse, it sounds like, even.
Sounds like.
Yeah.
It sounded like there have been a lot of alterations done by tenants over the years that were not done with the certificate of appropriateness.
Right.
Yes.
Hmm. Obviously without permits and such.
And without permits.
Mm-hmm.
What is Clark County's policy for bringing unpermitted work like into compliance with the code?
Code enforcement? We'd have to go to code enforcement, and then there's a series of letters. But this house is going into foreclosure.
Well, I'm thinking, you know, if it does get purchased by someone else, so like some jurisdictions, if you have unpermitted work that you want to bring into code compliance, you have to basically apply for a permit for the work that you did and go through the whole process. If they did that, then they would have to come for a certificate of appropriateness for that permit
right. mm-hmm.
that was already done. So I'm just curious what the process for unpermitted work is, for bringing unpermitted work into compliance with code in Clark County.
Sure, we could check our code on
right.
on how that works. We're not well versed on that
yeah.
process.
Is there land included with this purchase, with this property? I mean, is there land as well?
I think so, yes. And it's a kind of an interest, it's right up outside a hill, too, so.
Yeah. And that hill is kind of destabilized.
Yes.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, the way I read that email, it almost sounded like a candidate for demolition by neglect kind of property. And
what it looks like from the it's like the value of the property is in the land after you take the building down.
Right.
Do something else with it.
Yeah. So and sometimes land is worth more without the building than it is with the building.
And even then, you know, not that this is part of the purview, but it's a pretty small parcel and it's backed up by an unstable slope. It's got drainage issues, so whether there should even be a building there.
Sounds like a good place for vacant land.
Yeah.
yeah.
And that was where my head was going, was, well, what would be the path if demolition was the appropriate thing for this structure?
Mm-hmm.
Delisting, would that be a certificate of appropriateness?
appropriate.
Oh, yeah. That's the. Yeah. If you look at your diagram.
Yeah.
It'd be the waiver of a certificate of appropriateness, which is it's a demolition process, so it's got a little bit more extra stuff to it, process wise or requirements from the applicant, than mitigation requirements.
When this was listed, was it listed because of its use in the community as opposed to the structure itself? So it wasn't architectural significance. It was more historic significance because it was the post office, the gathering place for Gary, and the general store. So.
Right, and one of the few last ones in the county that was.
It'd be nice if the nomination forms were linked on the website.
We're working on that, too.
Okay.
Some are, not all are, but we'll get there.
Oh, put up a plaque, say what was there, say what was done there.
So, yeah, start thinking about things like that. Mitigation ideas.
Right, that no kid wanders inside and the building collapses on them while they're in there.
And then if you do grant the waiver and allow it to be demolished, you have a choice to delist it or leave it on the register.
I'm saying a mitigation measure might be to indicate this is the side of what was, mm-hmm. something like that.
Yeah, I think that would be the minimum that we would do. Hopefully we could work proactively with any potential buyer about trying to find solutions to save it. Maybe it's not possible, but I'm of the basic opinion of if you're going to tear a building down, then you really need to do your due diligence to see if there was a way to save it first.
I don't disagree.
If it's listed. And so, you know, if there's not, there's not. But you don't get to just say that there's not because, oh, it's obvious. No, you have to establish that it's not saveable.
I hear you, Sean. You want to bet?
The waiver, that code requires that.
Yeah,
they have to come up with a plan and
there has
demonstrate
to
you that there was no
waiver.
There's no
waiver. There's also a question about economic reasonableness, too.
Yeah, but you have to show that. You can't just say, oh, it's too expensive.
Well, you say it after you. No, you got to demonstrate it, of course.
Right. Yeah.
Right.
We both
part of that review that you yes.
over a long enough time that we know where it's going to come out. I think. I bet on it, but not.
Okay. Well.
Well, thank you. We'll relay, that what the steps would be for whichever process they decide to go at.
And I think there is, maybe you can say there is an interest in taking a trip, getting a
okay.
Going up there.
Mm-hmm. All right. Thank you.
Okay. Last of the new business, the New Heights Church. This was a recent addition to the agenda that Rock brought up, and Rock and I had a phone conversation, and I suggested that he bring it to the commission tonight.
So this item falls right into line with the demolition committee or the demolition permit committee's work and so forth. And if I can be a little more brief, if everyone has had read the email or had a chance to look at the bullet points and even look at some of the information that was online. Anybody?
I couldn't get the stuff to come up from the church.
Uh-uh.
I couldn't get them to work.
I could for one day, and then it stopped. So I have a feeling that they may have changed permissions on it.
Perhaps. Basically, the church. Everybody's familiar with the building. It's close by over here. It was a Presbyterian church built in 1912. It was a church for quite a few years, and then it was probably vacant for a period of time, and then the Columbia Arts Center occupied the space for a number of years, and most recently it was purchased by New Heights Church as their downtown west side campus. And they became more familiar with the building and its issues, I think they started to become a little concerned, had a structural analysis done, and found that basically the building is subject to seismic impacts to the extent that they ceased holding services there and are treating the building as though it's condemned, with concern of the safety of their parishioners. So now they're wanting to sell the property. They had a valuation done on the property in 2015 that now is probably out the window because the subsequent seismic analysis or structural analysis was completed in December of last year, so just a month or so ago. And their thinking is that more than likely the fate of the building will be demolition. So we've got this beautiful building, beautiful masonry structure, unreinforced masonry, that has been part of the fabric of the community for years and years. But what do you do with it? It's a little bit like the Sarah issue, and it falls into this whole pattern that we're identifying more closely with the demolition and how to record significant structures or non, you know, less.
And this isn't on any registers, and it's not
registered. Yep. Correct. Mm-hmm. Yeah, and they
have. So are
right? I would hope.
I assume it's on the inventory.
Probably.
So I want to read something from Sri Thirunagari, our chief building official, about this building. He said, the city's got no requirement to demolish the church. To the contrary, there's a covenant running with the land that addresses historical importance of the structure and specifically prohibits demolition.
Oh.
Well, good for the church to know.
That would be good for the church to know.
At least the seller, the buyers.
So I don't have a copy of that covenant, but I've never heard of a covenant that would specifically prohibit demolition.
I've never heard of
some
thing.
That was
itself.
Some far-sighted folks.
The city used to own that building. When it was the Columbia Arts Center, we owned it.
Yeah. Okay.
That might be.
So on sale, that was probably part of the covenant on the sale of the building?
I don't know. We probably need to track down the covenant.
So.
Building looks, it ought to be, I mean, compare this to the Sarah store, I'm sorry, this building looks to me like there's got to be some way, I mean, it's a beautiful building.
Yeah. There's
got to be some way to save this.
So I was able to read the
seismic. There are ways to save the building if you can afford the, you know, $5-6 million.
Is that expensive?
So I'll say, I read the seismic report, and there are, you know, the pictures were the most useful part. There are parts of it that are clearly just copied out of another report. You know, generic text about unreinforced masonry that has nothing to do with this building. So it's a decent report, but it's not a great report. There are a few things in there that if the statements about the way the building was constructed are true, it would be quite astounding, you know, about wall thickness and things like that. So have just a little bit of skepticism, not a ton, about the seismic report. But it does, I think, one of the big differences for this building is that it's not just that it's an unreinforced masonry building, it's that it's also in a deteriorated state. And there are certainly original construction quality issues with the building that can be seen in there. But it is totally savable. It is about, you know, I don't know that dollar amount is right, and I would certainly want an estimate that at least identified the seismic retrofit strategy before it gave a number for it, you know, to see something like that. Because there might be a covenant, but if the code official deems it's a life safety matter, it's going down.
Right.
But I would be interested if there's a, you know, proactive way that we can be involved with even potential buyers, because, you know, there's some really interesting things that you could do. Yeah, you could retrofit it to be a church again or a civic space again, you know, but you could also, I mean, you could turn that into an office building and basically just drop a moment frame into that building and put office floors in there. That would be an amazing space, especially with the shortage of office space that we have in Clark County right now. You know, you could put housing in it. I've seen, when I lived in Philadelphia, saw churches in way worse shape than that, turned into condos. So we know it's possible. And so if there's a way that we can facilitate, you know, whoever the purchaser might be, to think creatively and, you know,
make well, and boldly. Have a reuse that can get them a return on the investment necessary to protect them.
So, I mean, it'd be great if it can stay a church, but it would be better to save the building, even if it's not a church, than to lose the whole thing. And actually, doing the seismic retrofit with, you know, when you look at current use and then some of the other tax credit programs, if you're creative, if you got it on the National Register and you were creative about how you went after the historic preservation tax credits, you might be able to turn that into an office building for less money than it would cost to construct that many square feet of office building in that location. So it's not just a pure, oh, we have to sacrifice money to save it. Saving it may actually be the more economic path to viability for that site.
And the city has an adaptive reuse program that provides a whole bunch of technical assistance and other kinds of things for old buildings, difficult to reuse buildings.
Part of the, with the players involved, it's the discussion that I'm hearing kind of stacks up that the church is likely to become the loser in this because they will sell a property that requires a lot of work. It doesn't, you know, just the design work alone does not come cheap for a building like that and for the transformation, type of transformation that you're talking about. So it unfortunately, I don't know what the answer for the church is in this because now they've got a structure that is not anywhere near the value they thought they had or what their original investment was.
They should nominate it for the National Register.
Yeah.
I mean, that might encourage different set of buyers, people, you know, who are experienced with historic preservation tax credits and that kind of thing.
Well, when this discussion came up with my friend who's associated with the church and who has helped facilitate some of the study, the foregone conclusion sounded like demolition, and I was looking at, well, how can the commission help them in their recording of information in such a way that would meet the standard that we're trying to set up, whatever that standard might be as we're developing it. But maybe the discussion turns to become have you considered other options and what?
This is something that I feel like after almost 6 years on this commission that we see time and again that a lot of times the decision is a binary decision, and there's a lack of creativity, and I mean, as tired as the phrase is, thinking outside the box, and that people tend to look at these properties in black and white. You either can do it or you can't do it, when really there are a range of options. There are many shades of gray that can get you to an endpoint that is better than necessarily one extreme or the other, the black and the white. And, you know, I think maybe in places like Philadelphia, in Baltimore, in places that have a longer history, older buildings, more of a sense of retaining that history and repurposing it through the years, that there is a bigger willingness to look at these problems in a way and think outside the box on them. And it just feels like, you know, whether it's because we're on the West Coast and everything has got to be new, or what, but I just don't feel like a lot of the development decisions tend to just be one or the other. And we just don't get a wide range of options that we see for things like historic reuse and adaptive reuse kind of things. But that's my two cents. And this feels like a project that would be a good, I mean, you're coming to the commission tonight
with the assumption that the decision for demolition has already been made.
Oh, no.
Okay, that's what it sounded like.
But that's a likely outcome to this situation, you know, mostly on a monetary basis,
mm-hmm.
and who prospective buyers might be,
mm-hmm.
and what the timeline might be.
Well, that might be, you know, you say that the church is the loser, but if the building's not a lost cause, the church isn't as much of a loser. You know, if that building can be adapted, reused, you know, if it can be the basis for, you know, a cost-effective development of the site, you know, the reusing a historic building, it comes with a lot of code advantages. I mean, there's a lot more flexibility in repurposing a historic building than building a new building. So there are all these values that could be added to the buyer if the church is not, you know, saying, well, demolition's probably, you know, is likely. If they're saying, oh, no, there are all these opportunities. Yeah. You know, this is still an asset despite the condition it's in.
But they've got others. Well, if they went on the historic, if they went listed the building, then they would be under some of those protections. But because they're, you know, everything we're talking about, when you talk about putting a structure up the middle of the building and creating offices and floors and or condos or something like that, you're talking about a change of use.
Mm-hmm.
And as you know, a change of use means you're bringing the structure up to current.
So prior to it being, so it was a church, then it was an art center, then it was an office building.
Assembly space.
And then it was a church.
It was an office building.
It was an office. It was owned by Hash, which was a technology company. Uh-huh. And they built offices around the second floor. And they still kept the sort of ground floor as the big meeting space, but they did, it was an office building after the, because that's who the city sold it to, was a technology company called Hash that I know. Well, that,
yeah, it's hard.
I don't remember what kind of technology it was because it was years ago.
Yeah,
but
it's hard to tell what kind of agreement they went.
It does not sound like a technology firm.
I'm sure that stood, I think it was the guy's last name.
Oh.
Anyway, so.
So, you know, I'm not suggesting that they do those things, do the design, or, you know, I think listing, Alex is right, might force a certain kind of buyer, but at least to begin, you know, and maybe this is something that we can help them with, is talk about it as an asset for adaptive reuse that could be valuable to the buyer, that it's not just valuable as an empty lot, you know, with this horrible building that needs to be torn down, that it's valuable as a building that can be repurposed in all these interesting and creative ways, and the, you know, the right buyer, you know, and they might be able to sell it for more if they reposition the way that they talk about it.
Well, that maybe a appropriate step would be to set up some kind of meet with
have
the staff and then
have them come to a meeting.
Well,
might be intimidating.
I think. What they really need is to be educated,
yeah,
and informed. And I don't know if, you know, sitting through a meeting is he going to talk.
Well, when you're on the agenda.
Informs, but it maybe not in as pointed a way. As
but, I mean, they could be early on in the agenda if they're put on the agenda. I mean, you know, we just like.
You usually put guests at the beginning.
Yeah, I mean, just, you know, the deaf school came in and they were gone by, you know.
Right. But they really don't have anything to present. I think giving them information is the best thing we can do right now.
Or the private owners of that Heritage Register listed property last month. I mean, they came in and just said, you know, we have these ideas. It was very informal. They just said, you know, we've got kids. We need to put up some railings. Our property's on the Heritage Register. What do you suggest? I mean, that it was just an informational back and forth discussion.
Well, the other side of the other problem with that issue would be the timeline.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they're taking steps and they're moving forward. And do we ask them to, well, wait a month, come back in a month, and sit through a meeting, and we'll put you on?
Yeah,
it's probably not
okay.
The most efficient.
Let's start with Jackie, and mm-hmm. that would be you guys.
Us.
You can give them information about the current use program, you know, about the...
Yes, we can do the historic side.
Letting them know about the covenant, that might be a really important...
Well, we got to track that down.
Track that down.
That's just the word of the building official, because that would be good for them to know.
And
it's for a buyer to know.
We have no regulatory role in this, and so, the individual commissioners could play an informal role as well of, here's some ideas. You could think about doing it this way. You could think about talking about it this way.
Yeah, absolutely.
Let me start by trying to track down the covenant. Mark can track down the covenant. I don't have that.
Is this the downhill here?
Well, if it's a true covenant, it should be in the...
In the deed of record.
Yeah, the deed of record.
It's on there.
Yeah, so...
Depends on how long ago it was.
So at least let's find that information to start with. That might be the starting conversation. And you can go back to whoever you're dealing with and ask if they'd be willing to have a conversation about some other options.
Absolutely.
And maybe and emphasize to them that some of the other options might make the property more valuable.
Yeah.
And a building that needs to be demolished in order to reuse the land.
It would be a shame to lose that church.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Yeah, and that's why I heard, and I brought it forward.
Well, thank you for doing that.
Yeah.
I have one quick question before you close.
We got public comment, too.
Oh, public comment, too. I have one quick question. I think it's a yes or no answer. Can I? It's not related to this, but DAP did reply to your letter that you sent about the intangible cultural heritage.
That's right.
And he's asking if you want him to come down and give you a presentation of their 10-year work plan. Jackie and I heard this. They gave a presentation last month. He's asking if you would like that.
Their state preservation plan.
Yeah, mm-hmm. I think that would be good.
So you want to reply?
Yeah.
Especially since what was laid out in the email didn't give me a good idea of how well that aligns with what the subcommittee was talking about.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Useful.
Yeah.
Public comment.
Is it Wednesday yet? My name's Rob Fried. For those of you who don't know me, I was chair of the Historic Preservation Commission for about 7 years, about 12 years ago. And listening to your discussion about the Academy, it just brings up more frustrations. I share your frustrations with a reply from the city. I thought your letter was well composed. For many years, I was frustrated by the previous owners. They weren't stewards of the property. I saw the wooden laundry building deteriorate and fall apart. When I was on the commission, we offered them the opportunities for tax breaks. They turned everything down. They just basically saw dollar signs of wanting to develop the property around the buildings and obtain as much money as possible. Also feel frustrated about the historic overlay, development overlay district. None of us ever thought about the view from the southwest corner of the property with the Mexican restaurant there. We never thought of that ever being removed, so preserving the view shed from that angle just never really occurred to us. And there was pressure put on us from the city to parts of the city to try to increase the height of the build the height of the buildings that would be built around the Academy. And it is kind of a trade-off now. The trust buying the property and needing money to pay off the price of the mortgage, and so the price is developing the land around it, and it's a hard thing to balance, and I find it very frustrating. And seeing the buildings go up, and even at four or five stories, it is a huge visual impact to the property, I think. I guess to me the bottom line is that in reading Chad's letter, they're not embracing the spirit of historic preservation. And that's something you can't legislate. I'm sure the city goes by codes and state laws, local laws, but just trying to get lot of individuals buying into the spirit of historic preservation, it's frustrating. And hearing the discussion about the church, I mean, these are battles that we discussed 20 years ago, and they're ongoing. And so I share your frustration. I think you guys are doing a great job. And continue to fight the fight.
Thanks, Rob. And I think that brings us to the end of this meeting. So I will entertain a motion to adjourn.
So moved.
Second. All in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
Opposed.
Any opposed?
Yes. No.
Let the record show that Don.
It was not a unanimous decision to adjourn.
I want to say
you can stay, Don.